Today on the menu, a little corn and a whole lot of lobster.
And a little memo from the rest of the world to us. Enough already with the ethanol. Hey, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Coming up today, we're going to also be talking about JCPenney, which came in with some disappointing quarterly earnings this morning. And a lot of people are blaming their new pricing strategy. We'll dig into that with a retail analyst.
And earlier this week, the president of the Boston Federal Reserve Bank did something a little interesting, Jeremy. He said what he thought. And that's happening more and more than it has in the past with the Federal Reserve. We're going to talk with a longtime staffer there about the change in culture at the Fed. That and a bunch more coming up today on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The Agriculture Department has slashed its forecast for corn production this year by a worse-than-expected 17% because, of course, of the drought in the Midwest. Now, corn prices are at record levels, and corn is America's biggest crop. But as Scott Tong reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that could be part of the problem.
Corn is not the toughest crop for droughts. Its roots are shallow. Yet it occupies one-quarter of America's cropland. The U.S. is the world's largest producer by far. Thing is, most of it goes to ethanol or to feed animals.
Very little of it ends up as corn on a dinner plate. Most of it is turned into cows or cars.
John Foley directs the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. He estimates corn gets at least $5 billion in subsidies, creating distortions. More and more corn grown, less of everything else.
So this year, when there's a big drought, we have a very vulnerable system. We have this one crop covering most of the country. Imagine a mutual fund with only one company in it.
Many think the drought will restart a conversation to change that. It won't happen overnight. Corn interests argue their product provides food and energy security. But already, some ethanol subsidies have expired. And direct payments to farmers could end, too, when a tight-fisted Congress gets around to a farm bill. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
As Scott just said, a whole lot of the U.S. corn crop gets turned into ethanol, maybe some 40% of it this year. But the U.S. drought and the corn shortage here are driving up prices around the globe, so it's not surprising that when we're taking a lot of corn, making it into ethanol, people are a little annoyed. Well, the head of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization has now formally asked Americans to give the rest of the world a break and suspend those ethanol subsidies. Marketplace's Eve Tro has more.
U.S. corn is one of the world's most important crops. It gets ground up to feed people and livestock all around the globe. But a U.S. mandate for ethanol production means more and more U.S. corn has to go to biofuel. And that's the problem, says David Hallam. He directs trade and markets for the U.N. Food and Agriculture Organization. Hallam says the U.N.'s request for the U.S. to suspend its ethanol mandate isn't about stamping out biofuel production. It aims, he says,
to try and introduce some flexibility to the system so that the policies in place don't make matters worse.
The U.S. could introduce a clause that would suspend the ethanol mandate when corn prices reach a certain level, he says. That would free up more land to grow food instead of fuel. Hannah Stoddard at Oxfam says the food versus fuel debate is mostly about land.
The amount of land that it takes to fill just one car with biodiesel could feed a family of three for a month.
She says biofuel mandates have big companies buying up land in the U.S. and around the world, adding to the acreage devoted to fuel instead of food. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, corn prices may be rising, but lobster prices are at rock-bottom lows, and that is causing a cross-border fight between Maine lobstermen and Canadian ones. The Canadian lobstermen have been blocking their American counterparts from dropping off their catch at Canadian processing plants. They don't want to add more lobsters into the mix and further depress prices. David Thomas has been in the business for 37 years, and he joins us now from Aylesford, Maine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, take us right back to the beginning of this story. What is going on right now with the supply of lobster and the prices?
We are having a record 2 months of early soft-shell lobsters. And I have no idea what we're going to have this year, but we've just been swamped.
Now, you'd think that would be a good thing, but I guess if you're trying to sell lobsters and there are too many of them, it's not a good thing.
Well, we're a victim of our own conservation. We toss back lobsters with eggs. We have escape vents in our traps. The little ones get out the water is warmer than it was. There are fewer predators. So it's a perfect storm of events that are leading us to record catches.
And what has happened to prices then?
I'm selling lobsters now for the lowest price I've sold them for the last 35 years.
Wow. So after you catch and bring in your lobsters, you have to take them to a processing plant, and in many cases that plant is in Canada, right?
Yeah, there are 18 or 20 processing facilities in Maritime Canada and I think three in the state of Maine.
So you are really relying on the Canadians to process your lobsters?
We have been for years.
And they're saying, we don't want your lobsters because you're driving down prices over on this side of the border.
That's right. The Canadians had a good spring with hard-shell lobsters. Everything that could go wrong has gone wrong.
If there's a Canadian lobsterman listening to this right now, what would your message be to that person about your situation and why they should let you process your lobsters at their plants?
I guess I would apologize to them for even going and catching lobsters at the price they're at. But other than that, I would say the shoe goes both ways because all of those lobsters that we import into Canada come back to this country. It provides jobs up there, you know, for a lot of people.
David Thomas is a commercial lobsterman in Aylesford, Maine. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, at this point in the morning, Jeremy, doesn't look like it's going to be a very happy day for U.S.
stock markets.
Nope, they're down. The Dow down about 0.4%, so not terribly down, but down enough to be down. Asia ended down today. Stock markets there, Nikkei index down about 1%. And just clicking over to Europe here, looks like Germany's DAX down almost 1% as well.
Oil prices also down in New York trading today, but gas prices on the rise after that refinery fire near San Francisco earlier this week. More bad news for the U.S. Postal Service. It lost another $5.2 billion last quarter. Now, there's a debate over whether and to what extent Congress should step in to help. David Hendel is an expert on the USPS at the law firm Hush Blackwell. He says the service needs major restructuring, but he doesn't think it's going anywhere.
The Postal Service is going to be a vital part of the economy. It's already part of a trillion-dollar industry involving about 8 million people who are involved in it, if you consider people who are sending mail as well and depend on mail for their livelihood. It's not going anywhere. It's going to be here.
In fact, revenue for shipping services and package delivery was actually up 9% last quarter, thanks in part to sites like eBay.
Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, relatively new agency, starting to rev its engine. Today, they put out new rules governing the companies that service your mortgage. The CFPB's acting director, Richard Cordray, says even 5 years after the housing crash, dealing with your mortgage company can still be a nightmare for homeowners.
Right now, consumers often struggle to get critical information about their mortgage loans. Many have a hard time correcting errors. They often do not know about options to avoid foreclosure. And when they're trying to keep their homes and find options that make sense, they often get little help from their servicers.
The new rules require mortgage servicers to improve customer service. Direct ongoing access is what they say to staff members to help people trying to stave off foreclosure. Companies are also given a new mandate to quickly correct errors and supply information more quickly than has been the norm. And this may be the most important. Servicers will be required to stop foreclosure proceedings if homeowners apply for a loan modification program.
Well, JCPenney said this morning its sales were down 22% last quarter. That is the second straight quarter of steep sales declines, and it's being blamed in part on the company's new pricing strategy, which is, in a nutshell, no more special sales, just the same low prices every day. Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail, and she's with us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
So was this pricing strategy just too confusing for customers?
Well, I think two things. One is, you know, shoppers of JCPenney have shopped a certain way for a very long period of time. So that's very difficult for shoppers to get their head around. Number two is it begins to raise a question, you know, are these really the lowest prices or should I wait for a deal somewhere else?
Well, what do you think they're going to do now? Will they just take this away and go back to the way they were doing things before?
I don't think so. I think they will indeed become more promotional again. I think they can't go cold turkey. So there's already been some change, and I think there will be more change. I don't think they will go right back to the old ways, however.
Does it make it more unlikely that stores like JCPenney, which have been around for a long time, will take big risks like this?
in some ways, taking big risks at retail is very, very hard. And this may make people a little wary. But I think the other piece to this is that a lot of JCPenney merchandise is actually unique. It's private label. So there's not always been a basis of comparison. So I think this won't stop other people from making big change. I think it's just a very good learning of how you deliver that change, how you execute it.
Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Not a lot of big tech items on the show today, Jeremy, but just a couple tidbits here for folks. The rover Curiosity has been on Mars now less than a week, and somehow, I find this interesting, it's already time to upgrade the operating system. Just like everybody else. Seems like you're always having to upgrade your operating system. Well, suffice it to say, Curiosity is not going to get an advanced version of Windows 8. It's a little more nuanced than that. According to the website Computer World, there's a very good reason for the upgrade. Basically, the rover up to this point has been in landing mode, and that worked okay. And now it has to be upgraded to being on the surface mode, if you would call it that. And programmers on Earth are just starting that delicate process. And I'm imagining them with every keystroke. They're just sort of praying they don't get whatever the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's version of the blue screen of death from Windows.
Well, what it makes me think of is that the poor little rover is going to have to read the new terms and conditions that go along with the software upgrade.
Who's going to click? Who's going to click the box on Mars?
I don't know.
It's a good question.
You know Siri, of course, Jeff, the sometimes bossy Apple automated voice recognizing attendant.
I'm familiar, yes.
All right, well, now there's a new version of this, a new conversational assistant, as it's called, whose name is Winston. And Winston has just been released as a mobile app.
Good morning. The weather forecast in Manhattan is partly cloudy with a high of 89 degrees. On Facebook, Bert and Cookie Monster are celebrating birthdays today.
He is sort of charming, don't you think, Jeff?
He sounds a little like Michael Caine, as like Alfred the butler in Batman.
Exactly, or the butler from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or something. But so far, Winston does not have anywhere near the functionality of Siri.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Well, with the disappointing JCPenney earnings, some are already calling for the ouster of the new-ish CEO, Ron Johnson. The former Apple retail chief was brought in to revamp the brand and improve sales. So far, not so much success. For shareholders and corporate boards in various industries, patience with CEOs is wearing a little thinner. Data show the average tenure of a CEO has dropped from about 10 years to 8.5 years since 2000.
Tom Saporito is a CEO of RHR International. That's a firm of psychologists and consultants who work closely with top executives. And he's with us now for today's Midday Extra. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. So why is the environment for CEOs changing? Why is it different than it was, say, 10 years ago?
Well, there's a variety of reasons for that. One important reason is that the whole world of corporate governance is shifting. There's a much heightened degree of accountability, liability, scrutiny on the part of boards with their CEOs. So looking at performance in a much more detailed way is creating a level of turnover at the CEO level. Another reason is that CEOs are seeing the opportunity to create something, to turn around something, cash in, and move on to their next opportunity. The world of building something in a sustained way over many years, if not decades, that's a value shift that's going on, has been going on for several years. And so I think the motivation and the agenda of many CEOs has changed over the last number of years.
And that seems like it could be seen as quite short-sighted. I mean, I remember hearing that, if Seinfeld had had to, get itself really popular in the first couple of seasons, it never would have taken off and become the success that it was. Are CEOs being given enough of a chance to succeed?
I don't think there's any doubt about what you're saying. I think, we live in a world that's much more instant. We live in a world in which people want to see results on a much quicker basis. And, it's one of the reasons I think you see the shift from public companies to private equity back, because it gives companies a longer time frame. They can make investment decisions, and CEOs can prove or disprove their own leadership over a longer period of time.
They don't have to answer to shareholders.
And they don't have to answer to the shareholders, and they don't have to answer to the analysts, really, who will change their recommendation from a buy to a hold to a sell in quick terms, depending on quarterly or two quarterly performances. And sometimes companies like Seinfeld show needs a longer period of time to establish their strategies and to prove them as worthy.
I'm thinking about CEOs like Jack Welch, longtime CEO at GE, this era of the dominant CEO who is just completely identified with his company. Are we moving into a different phase of business now?
Yeah, I think unless you're talking about, the Jeff Bezos of Amazon and the Steve Jobs of Apple, there's less and less of the iconic CEOs that we saw in the past. I think the era of the Jack Welch's, where they could operate over such a longer period of time, there was more of a protective bubble combined with the level of performance that GE obviously created. We're going to see a lot less of that.
Well, okay, so if this is the direction we're going in, Tom, make us feel good about this. Is there any upside to, shorter, everything fast, 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 CEO better get it done right away?
Yeah. That's a great question. Is there any upside to it? I think maybe an upside of that is it creates opportunities for new blood to come in. People know they need to create something quicker and sooner. But quite frankly, I think like most things in life, we're looking at a pendulum that has swung that eventually needs to come back towards the middle, where the supply of capital is used to build something, not just for investors who are looking for a quick exit, but something that's meant to be enduring. That's where electric utilities were in the past. That's where the steel companies were. That's where the telephone companies were. That's where the banks were. And of course, globalization, competition, consolidation has changed all that. But it would be wonderful to get back to an era in which we build something that has far more of an enduring nature to it.
Tom Saporito, CEO for the long term, maybe, Tom, we'll see, at RHR International. Good to talk with you.
Good talk with you, too. Thanks.
Well, earlier this week, Jeremy, the head of the Boston Federal Reserve Bank, did something kind of unusual. He said what he thought. Eric Rosengren talked to the Wall Street Journal. He said he thought the Fed ought to do more to stimulate the economy right now. And on Monday, I think you're going to talk with Rosengren.
Yeah, right? He'll be on the show on Monday. You can hear, we'll have an extended interview right here on the podcast on Monday.
A nice extension of what we're just about to talk about now. So in the traditional world of the Fed, this kind of expression of ideas, independent of the Fed board itself, is a kind of high drama. Conventionally, the board acts by consensus. Chairman Ben Bernanke represents everybody. But there are board members who aren't quite on board with that consensus. And lately, those folks seem to be more vocal, usually through speeches, but occasionally through media interviews like the one we're going to do on Monday. Joe Gagnon has held a number of high-ranking staff jobs at the Federal Reserve Board, most recently in 2009. And he's now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Good to talk with you.
Good to be here, Jeff.
So, Joe, who are just a couple of the, let's say, occasionally dissenting voices on the Fed board right now?
Well, there's a group of people who are often called hawks because they tend to be in favor of relatively tighter monetary policy than the rest of the committee. Right now, the one of those of that group who has a vote is Jeffrey Lacker, president of the Richmond Fed. Lately, there has been a pulling away of a camp you could call doves, who are even more outspokenly dovish than the chairman. And I think Eric Rosengren is one of those. Another one would be Charles Evans, president of the Chicago Fed.
Is there an unusual amount of drama in the board right now?
You know, these meetings aren't terribly dramatic. they tend to be very cordial and respectful. But I do think that it does seem to me, reading from the outside, that there is more disagreement now than usual.
If things are a little more vibrant, if we're getting a better glimpse, perhaps, of occasional discord on policy within the board, what do you sense is Chairman Bernanke's take on that?
You definitely saw a progression from Volcker, who tried to suppress dissent, to Greenspan, who tolerated dissent, to Bernanke, who tolerates it or even encourages it more. Mm. And one thing I would say is that Bernanke seems to really respect the whole opinions of the committee and would pay some price to get unanimity or at least a large majority when it comes time to vote. So I think he sort of isn't the kind of chairman who's going to push through his narrow agenda with a narrow majority at all costs.
If this pattern of gradually increasing amounts of dissent on the board continues, is it possible the Fed board could stalemate at some point.
So what you could get is dissents on both sides. Then the question is, what if there wasn't a majority? What if it split evenly in a third, a third, a third for three different policies? What would they do? I guess they would probably have to do something in the middle. Two of the groups would have to reach some agreement in which they could pull together a majority. It would be very, very unusual, and I've never seen it before.
On the one hand, it seems natural that the Fed board would reflect some of the same passions and divisions that hold sway in the general public, right? On the other, should they be above all that somehow?
Well, I think they should be above all that, and I think surprisingly they are more than you would think. That's one of the interesting things that I saw as an insider, how really all of these members are really thinking about the greater good. You never hear politics in the room. And frankly, I never even saw decisions or votes that I thought could have been explained by ulterior political motives that were not in line with what I thought that person really thought was the best common good.
Joe Gagnon, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The ink is barely dry on the 2010 census, but the process of planning and tweaking the next population count is already underway. This week, the Census Bureau unveiled some ideas for changing how it collects data on race and ethnicity. Elizabeth Wynne Johnson reports.
Currently, race and the category Hispanic are two separate questions on the census form. Under one proposal, census respondents would have the option of choosing Hispanic as their race or origin. Nicholas Jones heads up the Census Bureau's racial statistics branch.
We tested out different ways of asking questions about how we measure the ways in which people self-identify.
The idea is to increase response rates, but some worry under the change respondents would fail to list specific ethnicities or countries of origin, and that ultimately that could affect funding for programs aimed at those populations. Roderick Harrison of Howard University is former chief of the racial statistics branch.
Most advocacy groups use census data to justify the need for programs or to argue for the need for more funding for programs that serve these populations.
The Census Bureau has several more years to tinker with the questions for the next survey. I'm Elizabeth Wynne Johnson for Marketplace.
If you think about the things we are not going to be using in the years ahead, you might think of stuff like small change, like pennies, like who needs those anymore, Jeff? DVDs, mm-hmm. I'm sure those are going to be on the way out with all the streaming that's coming in. But if you look at the success of the company Coinstar, which owns the DVD rental kiosk company Redbox, you might come to a different conclusion. Both businesses use machines to sell their products rather than human employees. The CEO of Coinstar, Paul Davis, joins me now from Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well. So you had 22% revenue growth in the latest quarter, 26% of that from Redbox. So how is something like Redbox able to do so well when Blockbuster is out of business?
Well, I think in many ways Redbox has filled sort of an unmet consumer need. We have, you know, 37,000-38,000 kiosks across the U.S., so we're within a five-minute drive of over 70% of the U.S. population.
But isn't, like, streaming on Netflix or going on Hulu or something like that easier even than taking a five-minute drive to a Redbox kiosk?
Well, in many ways, the convenience of having our locations where consumers go every day continues to win. We're not sticking our head in the sand. We believe that actually getting into the same space as Netflix makes a lot of sense. That's the reason we announced a joint venture earlier this year with Verizon, and we think we're well positioned to have the best of both digital as well as physical product in a winning solution.
Where do you see yourself expanding to going forward in the next couple of years?
Well, we're really excited about the seeds that we've been working on. We recently announced a partnership with Seattle's Best. It's in coffee.
Right.
And we have plans for thousands of those machines in, think about supermarkets, drugstores, mass merch, club accounts. We also have a concept that we're calling Orango, which is focused on refurbished used electronics at a great value.
So how many human employees do you have?
We're just around 3,000.
So that doesn't seem very high considering that you've got 60,000 locations for Coinstar, right?
Yeah, the business model that we've developed over the last 20 years is highly efficient and effective. So it doesn't take a lot of people to keep the equipment up and running. They're all remotely connected, so we have access to those. And with our Redbox business, as an example, we can take care of virtually 80% of the service needs remotely. So it's a very, very effective business model.
It may well be, but it's also kind of depressing for the future of the U.S. labor market. Is the future of U.S. business just machines rather than people?
Well, I don't think it's going to go that path. We believe that really what automated retail is a terrific intersection of both the brick-and-mortar stores as well as e-commerce. Consumers are very comfortable with technology. They like to control their own destiny because they don't have a lot of time on their hands.
We recently had one of our marketplace correspondents travel from coast to coast without ever interacting with a single human being. He just checked into hotels using the kiosks, went to the supermarkets where you could buy the food on the machines. I mean, is that where we're headed?
I don't think we'll ever get to that point. I think consumers will always want to have, you know, interaction with human beings. So we try to provide convenient solutions for consumers that are sort of where they go every day at a great value and serving consumers' unmet needs. So we think all of the, you know, all these channels can coexist in a very healthy way.
But you'll still side with the human beings if we ever get into a war with the computers.
Probably will.
Okay. Well, Paul Davis, CEO of Coinstar, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And finally, Jeff, Newcastle, California, there's a Denny's, and there were about 60 people dining on Monday for lunch.
Pretty good crowd.
When a mysterious woman approached the manager, and she said she wanted to pay for everyone's meal, everyone in the restaurant. She wanted to pick up the whole tab.
Was she mysterious? Did she dress mysteriously?
No, but she was definitely mysterious because nobody knew who she was or why she wanted to do this. She didn't say why she wanted to do it, and she was gone before anyone could thank her. The manager says the bill that she picked up was about $300. Although the waiters didn't make out too well, she only left them a 13% tip, which I found interesting.
$300 divided by 60 people, $5 a person.
I mean, maybe she wanted to make sure that that maybe she like didn't have good service there, and she wanted to make sure that the waiters did not get a good tip. So she said, I'll pay for everything. I don't know.
Well, the world could use a few more mysterious people brushing in and paying for our meals out of the blue.
I guess that's true.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.